from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, February the 12th, 2020, one day after the New Hampshire primary, and Bernie Sanders emerges there as with a narrow victory over the second place finisher Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and apparently the Tribune of the sort of moderate wing of the Democratic Party. Pete Buttigieg is emerging as that, and we're going to be talking with a couple different people, maybe a few different people, in the course of the next 2-hour radio program here about the results in New Hampshire, what they mean for the remaining primaries out there, and who might emerge as the Democratic nominee to take on Donald Trump in November. And we have a couple different people, as I mentioned. We're going to be talking later in the second part of the show with Linda Fowler, a political science professor from Dartmouth College, just over the river in New Hampshire. So we're glad to get somebody from New Hampshire to opine on the New Hampshire primary this morning. But we also have a Vermonter who's been watching all of this stuff closely. Matthew Dickinson is going to be joining me in just a moment from Middlebury College. He is someone I've been wanting to get on the show for a while, and so I'm really glad to have wrangled Matthew Dickinson for this morning. And in between, we're going to sandwich another, actually, college-affiliated person, who is Richard Schneider. He's not going to talk to us about the New Hampshire primary, but he's going to talk to us about the fact that his presidency at Norwich University is coming to a close. He's retiring this year and just completing a $100 million fundraising campaign. Actually, I think they netted $121 million down at Norwich University. They've been spending some of it on some beautiful new buildings, and the campus really looks terrific these days. So we're going to be talking with President Richard Schneider of Norwich University in the second half hour of the program this morning. But let's get right into the New Hampshire primary with Matt Dickinson, who I believe is on the line from Middlebury this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining me. So, I've been watching some of the commentary coming out of New Hampshire, and it looks like people are basically saying about Bernie Sanders that, you know, a win is a win, but it wasn't exactly a trouncing for sure.
It wasn't. Historically, his percentage, he's at about 26%.
Mm-hmm.
That is the lowest percentage total for a winner in the Democratic primary going back to 1952, if I've scanned my records properly.
Mm-hmm.
This is to take nothing away from it. I mean, he finished above everybody else, but if you're thinking of this as a defining victory that clears the field, I think that's a misconception.
Yeah, I think that Bernie Sanders is definitely, you know, he's got his base. People liken it a little bit to President Trump in terms of the sort of the fervency of his followers and the intensity with which people are following him. But does this really indicate that he's been unable to expand his base and start bringing in more people?
I think that's exactly right. I was at his rally over the weekend in New Hampshire, and two things struck me. One, it was an enthusiastic crowd, but there weren't people there out of curiosity. Remember, about 40% of New Hampshire's went into that last weekend uncertain who they were going to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't showing up at Bernie Sanders' rally, as far as I could tell. He had a committed group of passionate Bernie supporters, but exit polls suggest most of the Bernie supporters had made their mind up several months ago that they were going to vote for him. So, you know, you look at his coalition, it is passionate, it's core supporters, they're going to come out. The question for him has always been, can he expand that? And when you look at the messages, and again, I was at their rallies over the weekend, the Peter Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, they're making the case that Bernie divides as much as he unites, and that's not going to be enough to beat Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, Bernie Sanders has a record in Vermont in which he has been able to reach out to many different spots on the political spectrum and attract actually some Republican votes. You know, if you just look at vote totals from, say, towns in Republican parts of the state and so on, in his congressional and Senate elections, he has drawn support from even Republicans in Vermont and certainly a lot of independents. And so why is that not translating into this presidential race?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, let's be clear. When we look at his support in 2016 in New Hampshire, a significant amount of it came from independents. the difficulty, I think, in 2016, he was the alternative to the establishment candidate who was not well-liked, Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can understand why independents looking for an alternative to the parties would either go for him or, as we know, many of them went for Donald Trump, two anti-establishment candidates.
Yeah.
Now, in 2020, the dynamics, I think, have changed a little bit. It's no longer enough for Democrats to have a protest vote. They want somebody who can beat Donald Trump. And there are a number of candidates out there saying, look at Bernie's record. He cannot do that. This is not Vermont. God bless Vermont, but we're a blue state. This is a presidential election that needs to draw on a diverse coalition, and Bernie's not the guy to do that. I think that is the message that Buttigieg and Klobuchar have been running on, and Biden will, too, when we get to South Carolina. And it's resonating.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, but there's this disconnect that I'm still trying to figure out between Sanders' record, and admittedly, Vermont's a tiny electorate and may have some weird stuff going on here that just isn't translatable nationwide, but the extent to which Bernie Sanders has been able to attract support from across the ideological spectrum in Vermont, it just seems to me kind of odd that he has not really been able to do that, at least so far. It doesn't look like it. He has not been able to break out of his core, very liberal or left-leaning base in the national either in Iowa or in New Hampshire so far. And I'm just wondering, is he going to be able to attract labor support? Is that something that is he going to be able to kind of beat, you know, the Amy Klobuchars and Joe Bidens and Pete Buttigieg's of the world to union endorsements in upcoming primary states?
Well, that's a great question. We know exit polls suggest that the New Hampshire supporters for Sanders were disproportionately liberal and disproportionately young.
Mm-hmm.
Looking ahead, I assume he's going to continue drawing on that group. But one of the issues that came up, and Klobuchar really hit at this at her rally, Sanders' support for Medicare for All, Klobuchar's response is, well, you're going to throw many people, including people of labor unions who have signed contracts that have very generous health care benefits, and you're basically going to throw them off those health care benefits. And we see, you know, there's been a couple labor unions in Nevada, according to news reports, the upcoming crucial caucus state, that are urging their members to vote against Bernie for precisely that same reason. So, yeah, I mean, it's one thing to win in races that are not very closely contested in a small state like Vermont, and if you're an independent or somebody who's unsure to vote for, but you know Sanders is going to win, you have less incentive to sort of consider other candidates. But in the national sphere, I think he's going to face some headwinds going ahead.
Yeah, now let's talk a little bit about Sanders' support or how strong it is, how soft it is, whatever, in the African-American community and among Latinos and other folks, you know, more diverse ethnic racial states, I'm not phrasing this very well, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, one of the upcoming races, Latino people, I understand, make up about 30% of the electorate, at least in the Democratic primary in Nevada. Has he been working to organize in Latino communities out there?
Well, this is the crucial question going ahead, I think, not just for Sanders, but for Buttigieg and Klobuchar.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden, the former vice president, has staked his campaign on attracting Latino and African-American vote. As you point out, Nevada, growing population of Latino voters there. South Carolina, majority-minority. Can Sanders expand his coalition? This was his Achilles heel. In 2016, the reason that Clinton was able to beat him overall was because of her support among communities of color. To his credit, Sanders has responded to that. He has shaken up his staff. He has a lot of people of color in very visible positions. I was at his rally in New Hampshire, and Nina Turner, the former state senator from Ohio, gave a barnstorming speech on his behalf. But we don't have any evidence yet about whether that's resonating with these communities of color. We just don't know at this point. Anecdotal evidence, I have students from you know, African-American communities down in Atlanta who say among younger voters of color, Sanders support is actually rising. It's the older voters that are resistant so far as we can tell. But all of this is, you know, it's somewhat, we're just guesstimating without any actual voting at this stage.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to me because Sanders certainly has a record. You know, he famously marched with Martin Luther King in the March on Washington in 1963, and was involved in the early efforts at the University of Chicago to bring desegregation there, and so on and so forth. And yet, it seemed in the 2016 race, I remember I was still a reporter for the Associated Press back then, and I was covering writing various stories about Sanders' candidacy, just from his record in Vermont and so on. One of the issues that kind of came up was it seemed as though his sort of understanding of the dynamics of race in America were almost in amber or something. They were sort of preserved from 50 years ago, and that needed some updating. Do you think there's some truth to that? A and B, has he been able to do that?
Well, Dave, I think this is you've hit on a crucial point. When you hear his rallies, and we've seen this in a couple debate performances, when he's asked about race relations or issues related to civil rights, he instinctively pivots to his economic message. And his argument is, the way you deal with racial inequality, racial bias, and so on is, the rising tide, let's give them economic opportunity that they don't have. And for many members of the black community, that is a little bit of a tone-deaf response. It doesn't get at the underlying structural inequities that have, for many African Americans, reflect sort of the systemic racial bias. Now, again, Sanders has assiduously sought to change his message and to move beyond sort of this economic focus. And you notice in his victory speech last night, he talked about this multiracial coalition that they're trying to build. I think he's going to do better among racial minorities than he did in 2016. The other point we should make here is his main rivals, other than Biden, Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, they haven't shown any evidence that they'll get any support among African Americans. So if you're a Sanders supporter, I would be a little more optimistic that he's going to broaden his support within those voting blocks. How much? I think we have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think historically Sanders has had, if he's had a liability, it's really been that he views too much of the world too firmly and too often with a sort of, old school Marxist class analysis, and that he is somebody who's unable to really filter his political thinking in ways other than that, and that's this kind of go-to framework. And that when you talk about issues of race, there's just a lot going on in America's racial history that is not directly where that's just frankly the wrong tool in a toolbox to get at it. I've seen other issues where Sanders over time has wanted. He was early in his career. He was not real strong on the environment. I think he sort of thought it was one of these boutique issues where it was only the rich who cared about saving the caribou or whatever. He's come around to that now, where he's quite an environmentalist, but it hasn't been his instinct, has it?
No, it hasn't. I mean, in his defense, I think a lot of politicians were a little slow on the environmental issue, and he is making great strides and at least rhetorically addressing that. But your point about sort of that single-mindedness, I think, is just absolutely spot on. At his rally, and I wrote a piece about this in my Presidential Power blog, there is a certitude, a moral certitude underlying his economic populist message that comes from a deep wellspring of authenticity. This is what this guy is about. It is all about redressing the inequities in society that rooted primarily in economic disparity.
Yep.
And that spills over into everything from education policy to health care. And if he doesn't see the immediate economic dimension to the problem, he can sometimes be a little bit tone deaf on, how relevant it is to to particular voters. And, you know, to his core supporters who share that worldview, that is a strength for him. But for those who do not, this is where his candidacy sometimes stumbles. He has trouble reaching out. And, you know, we're really now getting into the meat of this race when we move into Nevada and South Carolina. We'll really get a test about how well he's adjusted his message and how it's playing.
Matt Dickinson, how do folks find that if they are looking for your commentaries on the presidential politics?
Well, they can access it off the Middlebury College webpage or just Google my last name, Dickinson and Presidential Power, and that should get there.
All right. We will... I'm sure there's some folks out there clicking away at their keyboards right now, and so it's good to get you into our stable of commentators here on the Dave Graham Show too. I really appreciate you joining me this morning, and hope we can make this a somewhat regular thing in the future. But I wanted to we've been kind of beaten up on Bernie Sanders a little bit, and one of the things I kind of wanted also to give him a little bit of credibility here, because years ago, again, when I was a reporter for the AP, I went up and I covered the big news conferences in Jay and Newport, at which they were announcing these EB-5 projects that ended up being kind of a financial disaster and all the fraud charges, et cetera, we've talked about for years now. But at the beginning of all this, there was these presentations where essentially all the leading Vermont elected officials went up there for these two news conferences, which I was covering that day. And I remember being really struck by the fact that, typically at ribbon-cutting events and stuff, politicians tend to talk in kind of platitudes and just kind of glad hand, et cetera. Bernie Sanders got up there. The hall was packed with construction workers. They wanted to bring in a good audience, so they just told the guys to put the tools down and come on over to the meeting room where this big event was being announced. And this is at Jay Peak, I remember. And so the place is, packed with these guys in their Carhartts and boots. And Sanders basically got up there, and instead of talking about, Jane and I or being so happy to be back here in Vermont or whatever, he went right into what essentially to me sounded like a college sociology lecture. Where he was telling these guys, about the real meaning of bringing jobs to the Northeast Kingdom and how that was going to, affect the local economy and so on and so forth, in some frankly kind of mind-numbing detail. And I just thought, one thing he's doing here is, or one thing he's not doing is he's not talking down to a bunch of people who don't have the same, level of education that he does. Not at all. And he's bringing them right along. And I was kind of amazed and impressed by that, frankly. Is that something that can translate nationally?
It has translated nationally. When you think about, and I was at an Elizabeth Warren rally right after a Bernie Sanders rally this weekend in New Hampshire, and the comparison between the two I thought was revealing. There's not a dime's worth of difference on their issues, but Bernie attracts broader support, and he attracts stronger support among middle to lower income individuals and younger people. And the reason, I think, is there's a level of authenticity that when he speaks about these issues, he does so not in a way that strikes you as I'm pandering to the voters to say what they hear. He's saying something that he's been saying, you covered him for 40 years.
Yep,
this
yep.
guy, he believes this in his heart.
Uh-huh.
This isn't a political position. This is a passion of his life. And in an era of uncertainty and fake news and so on, my students eat this stuff up because he provides a picture of a world in which there are villains and there are good people, and he's on the good people's side.
Mm-hmm.
And he is waging this war for the soul, the economic soul of America, and in no uncertain terms. And people believe him. They trust him. And that's because you're, I think, exactly right. This is what he believes. He is an unrepented democratic socialist.
Yeah. I was watching a clip the other day of Pete Buttigieg giving a speech, and a friend of mine was sitting next to me and watching it with me. And Pete speaks very well, and he comes across in a kind of a comforting presentation most of the time. And yet her comment was, and I will tell you, she's a Bernie supporter, and so take this for what it's worth, but her comment was essentially that Pete's speech was mostly devoid of content. I mean, it's all about working together to make progress in America, and you know, and this woman who's sitting next to me going, working together on what? To make progress on what? How's he going to go about this? Et cetera, et cetera. It was kind of a funny little exchange between this viewer and I think a YouTube clip or something. And is that something that, whereas Bernie Sanders, you know, the one thing you can say for him is that he doesn't spend a lot of time glad-handing and sort of delivering pablum. He actually wants to talk about real stuff, and even if you disagree with him, you sort of have to give some credit for that, right?
Yes. The contrast in the two rallies, I attended a Buttigieg rally both in Iowa and in New Hampshire, and Sanders will go point by point, right down from climate change, from gun control, from health insurance as a human right, prescription drugs, higher minimum wage, boom, boom, boom. This is agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Buttigieg will paint a picture about, you know, we want evolution, not revolution. We need to come together. And it is said in such a soothing tone that if you want to get past sort of the divisive politics of the tweeter in chief, he is beguiling you, but
mm-hmm.
We've seen flashes on the debate stage where he's attacked on his record, and he sort of freezes like a deer in the headlights. We saw this when the questioner in his most recent debate asked him about his civil rights record. I think because of his performance in Iowa and in New Hampshire last night, he's got a target on his back, and people are going to start making the point that your friend made, which is, let's push this guy on his policy details. Let's unpack this and see exactly what he is proposing out there, and do we support it more than we support Bernie?
All right. Well, Matthew Dickinson, that's about all the time we have this morning, but I really appreciate you joining me, as I mentioned, and let's do this again sometime soon.
I'd love to, Dave.
All righty. We're going to take a brief break for some bottom of the hour CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM, and we'll be back. We're going to talk to Richard Schneider, president of Norwich University, in our second half hour.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're going to stay with our collegiate crowd in the next half hour of the program. We just had Matthew Dickinson, one of the political science professors from Middlebury College, talking about the New Hampshire primary. And we're going to be talking with Linda Fowler of Dartmouth College about the New Hampshire primary in the second hour of the program today. But we wanted to, even though we're staying in that university college world here for a little bit, we wanted to shift gears some and talk about a big success story at Norwich University in Northfield, Vermont. President Richard Schneider is joining me on the air this morning. And President Schneider, thank you so much for doing so.
Hey, David, thanks so much for covering the story. I appreciate it. And good morning, everybody.
Hey, so tell me, you announced some pretty exciting news on Monday. Just give us the headline.
Sure. Norwich University has completed its bicentennial fundraising campaign, which was called Forging the Future. And we had originally set a goal of $100 million, which, David, is a lot of money for anybody, but especially a small school and in our state, and we surpassed that goal, and we raised $121 million from wonderful alums and friends of Norwich, so we've secured hopefully our future for the next 100 or 200 years.
Yeah, it's, I got to say, it also is kind of a remarkable achievement given the dark clouds surrounding a lot of higher education these days, and what is the... What's the key to success in this age of, you know, other schools closing and trying to get mergers going and other stuff happening?
Well, for all of your listeners, it really is a tough time for higher ed. I mean, the demographics are against us. So especially in New England, we just don't have the number of students going to college like we used to. But Norwich is a national school. We attract students from all over America. In fact, it's a international school. We probably have about 140 international students here. But we are very relevant, David, and my heart breaks for these smaller liberal arts schools, especially our friends in Vermont. These were wonderful schools with great values and great education and good faculty members. But America wasn't buying what they were selling. And it's all about relevance. Are you offering the academic programs that the students want? So at Norwich, our business model is very simple, David. We will educate and prepare our students for the risks against this republic. And if we do that faithfully, the republic should send us their best students. And that's exactly what's happened. So, David, we are absolutely full. I can't take one more student. I've got quads filled and triples filled, and I've taken back lounges and put students in them for birthing spaces because we are overwhelmed with wonderful students who want to defend us and work on preparing and improving this republic. So we are in good shape for the shape we're in.
And refresh me, how large is the student body there?
Well, the core is at 1,600. It's never been that large. And the civilian students are 800, so that's the residential population, mm-hmm. which is all now in Northfield, so 2,400 students. So we are the largest private school or independent school in Vermont. Now, UVM, of course, is much bigger than we are, but they're state-supported.
Yeah.
Well enough, by the way, for all your listeners. We got to support them more, but we're the largest private one. In addition to those 2,400 undergraduates, and by the way, we build school just like the Department of Defense, two in uniform for every civilian. You can't go to war without your contractor anymore or without a three-letter agency person embedded in the military units or working with NGOs. Those are non-governmental agencies. So mm-hmm. for young officers, war is much more complicated than it was when I was commissioned in the United States Coast Guard in 1968. We also have 2,400 graduate students, and all your listeners, if they don't have a graduate degree, I can fix them and get them one. But online, it's built for working adults, about 20 hours a week or so is required to do good work. But you can get, we have about 13 different programs at the graduate level. So we do require that you come to campus for a week in June.
Mm-hmm.
Like, David, how cool is that to be in Vermont in June, right?
And I can stand it.
Those are national programs. And by the way, when they come, they usually bring their spouse and their kids. Of course, I'm recruiting their kids every day too.
Oh yeah.
And you know, the governor and the legislature love us because we're bringing all these visitors to Vermont to spend wildly, as we tell them.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Keep those Northfield restaurants humming.
Oh, listen, you know when there are Norwich visitors here. So homecoming is a huge deal, and Rook Arrival Day, Freshman Arrival Day, graduation, of course, Commissioning Day. We flood all of Central Vermont. It's not just Northfield, but this homecoming that we just had to celebrate our 200th birthday, David, they were living as far away as in Burlington at all the hotels in Burlington, all the way down well past White River Junction.
And wow.
Yeah.
That's a that is a big economic impact. I know there are certain weekends. I live in Montpelier, and there are certain weekends when the character of Montpelier changes a bit because something's happening at Norwich, which is only 12 miles or so south in
right.
Northfield. So,
well, with this homecoming to celebrate our 200th birthday, and by the way, we're the 40th oldest school in America.
Hmm.
Yeah, and it's a really kind of remarkable thing. Only two schools, I think, have stayed true to their original mission, the United States Military Academy and Norwich. But the fact that we're so old, we had 6,000 alums here. Now, let me tell you, when you put 6,000 people in Central Vermont notices.
Yeah, yeah. That's very true.
Right.
Now, what about, I mean, Northfield is not supremely accessible. There's no interstate highway that goes. I mean, I-89 sort of goes nearby, but that's kind of a haul from any airport or
Well, it is true that, yeah, we're an hour from Burlington Airport, which is the primary airport for us, and we're so thrilled that they're growing. Mm-hmm. I got to tell you, when I became the president in 1992, they said that when I was coming up for the interview, they said, well, we'll meet you at the airport. I said, well, where in the airport are you going to meet me? They said, don't worry about it. We'll find you. It was an international airport, and there were two gates.
Yeah.
I think only two gates in 92.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they did find me. I didn't get lost in that airport.
Reminds me of the day I interviewed at the AP Bureau in Montpelier, and they talked to me for a little bit, and I said, go out and take a walk around town. We want to talk about you. And come back in 20, you know, half an hour or something. And I went and I walked around downtown Montpelier and for like 20 minutes and came back 10 minutes earlier than I had been instructed. And one of the interviewers said, so what'd you think? And I said, well, I only went down this State Street, what was State Street and Main Street a little bit. And so, I only saw a little part of it. And the response came back, oh, no, you saw the whole thing.
Yeah, but you know what? I love it here. In fact, when we retire, my wife Jamie and I retire this May after being here 28 years, and I've loved it here. But we're going to stay in Vermont. We have a camp over at Lake Dunmore that I've been working on for about 6 years, and it's been a money pit for the last 6 years, but it's ready to live in year-round. So we'll be able to listen to you.
Awesome.
And we're going to be around.
Uh-huh.
We're going to leave the new president alone. We're not coming back to campus for a year or two. We'll let the new president get seated and get established. But we're going to be cheering from the sidelines.
What about, thinking about getting into Vermont politics? Is there a Governor Schneider in our future or something?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. Yeah. No, I don't think that's going to happen. I'm not really qualified to do that. But I'm just a simple physics teacher and a Coast Guard officer.
And 28 years, you're just to refresh people here now, you are going to be stepping down, I believe, in June, is it?
Yes, on the 1st of June, our new president should take over, and Jamie and I will be going to camp, and we're going to go fishing and maybe think big thoughts, I don't know, but I'm 74 now, David, and thankfully I'm still in good health, and we're going to have to do something. We believe in giving back and helping others, but I have promised Jamie that the first summer is hers. I am not doing anything for anybody. But after the 1st of September, I'm going to have to do something, or I'm going to drive her crazy, and she's going to drive me crazy.
Maybe is there a book in your future?
I don't know. People have asked me to write one about leadership in higher ed and how you – and we did a big turnaround here. This is a wonderful turnaround story at Norwich. I've thought about that, but I think I'd rather help presidents survive. David, we got some really tough sledding ahead of us, I think, in Vermont and in higher ed generally. And you started with your question, and I didn't really have a chance to answer it completely, but the three things that I think are critical for higher ed, actually, or any business for that matter, in Vermont or New England, is you have to be relevant. That is, people have to believe and buy what you're selling. Second, it has to be flexible. In today's market, students are expecting much greater flexibility than higher ed is usually willing to give. For example, I have students that want to study in China or Europe or South America or places like that. Well, you got to make it work for them. We had 95 students off campus this fall studying overseas. And then it has to be affordable. I mean, this is the killer. I mean, people say, why is higher ed so expensive? Well, let me tell you, when I went to the United States Coast Guard Academy, I paid for my entire technology budget. I think it was $28.50. I bought a K&E slide rule.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the technology budget. Well, my budget at Norwich here is $9.5 million for technology alone. And then you add healthcare on it because in higher ed, about half your expenses are people, which is a very high-touch industry. It takes a lot of people to deal with your 18-year-olds, and that's an expensive thing, especially with healthcare. And so we are doing fabulously well, but, I mean, I still would like to have more money for my faculty and my staff to do the things they'd like to do. But if you're not relevant, you're not flexible, and you're not affordable, I'm telling you and your listeners, you will be out of business.
Yeah. Hey, one thing that you've gotten some black eyes in the media recently, especially relating to you know, some of the young folks on campus there who occasionally misbehave, frankly.
Yeah.
What can be done to keep a lid on that and kind of get people to realize that, you know, this stuff does reflect badly and so on?
Well, we certainly teach them this all the time. You remember, I'm living with 2,400 teenagers, and that's a lot of students, right?
Yep.
And so I don't want to have everyone judge our school and our other great students by just the bad actions of, you know, four students.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very disappointing because we expect more from our students than that.
And I wonder also, I wanted to get back, though, also to this fundraising drive, which does just seem to be, I mean, $100 million sounds like a nice round number, you know. Was it picked only because it was a round number, or did you have a real kind of a vision for here's how we're going to spend the money? And I know you've been spending some of the money on some new construction down there and stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, we actually had a clear vision of what we wanted. I wanted $300 million worth of stuff, and I have good reason to spend $300 million, but we couldn't raise $300 million.
Yeah.
What you do in fundraising is you get your ideas together of what you need. So this is, by the way, this bubbles up from the very deck plates of the place, from the faculty and the staff. What do we need to do to be a world-class organization? And I did that exercise, and we came up with about $300 million of investments we could make. Then we go out to a couple major, maybe 25, 30 of our significant donors, and talk about all those things. What would they be interested in supporting? Because you have to align your donors with what your needs are. Because some donors will only give you money for the things that really are exciting to them.
Yep.
They won't give you money for a new roof, for example. That's not exciting.
Yeah, people don't want to give you the money for the music hall or whatever.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right? So you have to line that up. And so we did that, and we felt we could raise $100 million. The fact that we raised $121 million is remarkable in today's environment. But I had specific things to do with all that money. The first, by the way, this is the first campaign I've had without an athletic component. This is very unusual. I've run five campaigns now, and they normally have a component for academics, a component for affordability, that means scholarships, an athletic component, because athletics is such an important thing to Norwich. And that's where we do our leadership training, and that's where we build teamwork, and we teach you when you get hit and you get knocked down, damn it, you get back up and you get back in the fight. Those are important life skills, resiliency that we teach. But this one didn't have any athletic component in it because I was really trying to finish strong with academics. And they needed the most help in their building. So in this money, this $100 million, we spent $25 million alone on one new building called Mack Hall. $5 million of that was technology in that building, and it is a world-class cyber facility. Because cyber is one of the great threats to this republic. So we need to produce the next cyber set of officers that our military needs and our government needs. And by the way, industry needs this too. I mean, I'm sure your station has been attacked before, and that's not good. And so the country doesn't have enough cyber specialists, so we're trying to produce them for the country. So $25 million was for there. Then we had a bunch of other buildings that needed renovation and updating. By the way, this is the ticking time bomb in higher education. Institutions are not keeping up with their deferred maintenance, and eventually it is disastrous. And that's one reason why it's very difficult to sell these vacant campuses, because you have to put so much money in them to make them compliant. ADA, the American Disabilities Act, alone. So
fire codes and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So what colleges have been doing is underfunding that because it's not as obvious. It does get to be obvious, though, when your roofs start to leak or you can't make heat and steam and things like that to keep your kids warm.
Yeah.
This is very expensive. We all built these buildings, you know. Some of these buildings are 100 years old at Norwich. Now we all keep them clean. And we keep them well-maintained at Norwich because it's a military thing. Your equipment has to work for you or you're dead.
Yep.
And so we have always maintained our buildings, but we needed some new ones and we needed to update some other ones. I put $7.5 million right in the library. You know, libraries have changed dramatically in the last 20 years with online books.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need all the stack space, which is very expensive to build because it's very strong space.
Yep.
So I've converted two floors of our library into another kind of space that we needed, like academic achievement space to help tutor students or counseling center. Or we actually made, believe it or not, a coffee lounge in the library. Now, every dead librarian is probably turning over in their grave because you could never remember when we were at school, you could never have food or
drink. Yeah, in the library.
Liquid in the library.
It.
Oh, well, now, you know, think of Barnes & Noble. Is this really a problem? I don't think so. And so we built like a Barnes & Noble cafe in
right
our
in the library.
Library.
I was down there a few months ago visiting, and I must say I was a little shocked. I said,
yeah.
Oh, what is this world coming to?
But hey, you know what? David, here's the lesson.
Yep.
It quadrupled the number of kids going to the library.
All right. That's thinking. Hey, making yourselves relevant, for sure. I was just reminded of a longtime legends I've heard about a couple different schools, supposedly, you know, universities building big, beautiful new libraries, and then the architects forget to account for the weight of the books, and they load them up with books, and the libraries start to sink into the earth, I guess.
That's not been a problem at Norwich.
Okay.
We know how to build buildings.
Yeah.
I want to tell your listeners, too, when you talked about how bad it is that some of these schools are closing, the other critical element besides being relevant, flexible, and affordable is you got to do a good job on your planning, on your strategic planning. And then you work that plan really hard and to write it and get everybody to agree to it and get alignment so that everybody's pulling the oar at the same time. And then you execute that plan. And it's really about 10% planning and 90% execution. Now, every military guy knows that a plan is a great thing to have until you make first contact with the enemy. Then you got to change the plan because they did something different.
Yep.
And that's true today. Higher ed is changing more in the last 4 years of my presidency than in the first 40 years of being an academic.
Hmm.
And it's amazing what's happening. It's so exciting. In fact, I kind of wish I was an assistant prof starting all over again because of all the changes. But if your school isn't willing to change, I think you're going to be dead.
Speaking of assistant profs starting all over again, one tale of woe I hear from academia is that for young people coming out of university PhD programs looking to get them on a faculty somewhere, it's a tough road. You know, a lot of people take these adjunct jobs where they're being paid, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 a semester to teach a course, and you put a couple of those together, and you're still below $10,000 in income. And
it is not the way the system was designed. We use adjuncts especially for specialty courses that we can't afford to have a specialist in.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we have a broad spectrum of engineering courses here. And let's say we would love to teach a course, a specialty in fabricated concrete or something like that, and we might not be able to have a full-time guy that does that, but we can hire a person that does one course.
Mm-hmm.
It is a tragedy what's happening with adjuncts. But you know what? They should have known what they were getting into when they went to grad school. The good ones are still finding positions, but I'm telling you, the number of positions are dropping.
Yeah.
Now, we're still hiring at Norwich because we're still growing, but there are a lot of schools that are not because of the demographics. So, yes, it is tough for them. In addition, some of them took programs that really the only other useful thing to do is to teach. Where if you had a technology degree or a STEM degree at this point, boy, there's so much need for smart, well-trained, educated people in business, in engineering, in the sciences. All of you, your listeners, I'm a big STEM believer. That's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And
yep.
Norwich has great liberal arts programs, but we have huge numbers of professional programs. And by the way, that's another reason why I think we're in business, David. The students know that they can get really high-paying jobs coming to Norwich and graduating, not just from the Department of Defense, but all over the place. So that's
yeah.
The relevance part. What do they need? So we have a rule at Norwich. No more than 20% of the teaching can be done by adjuncts at Norwich. 80% has to be done by full-time people. And that has limited our use of adjuncts greatly. That is not the average at most schools. Some schools are down to 50% teaching by adjuncts and 50% by full-timers.
Wow.
That's simply not right, I don't think. And so we have kept to the Norman Rockwell kind of tradition of being a high-quality New England, small, undergraduately focused, great teaching place.
Excellent. President Richard Schneider of Norwich University, I thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Oh, I love it, David, and good luck to all your listeners.
Thank you so much.
All righty.
We're going to head into our top of the hour break for some CBS news and very shortly here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. Folks, don't forget about our podcast. If you missed any part of that interview with Richard Schneider of Norwich University, you want to catch that, or the previous one with Matt Dickinson of Middlebury College, just go to WDEVradio.com. Follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down and you'll find a list of our recent programs. We'll be back very shortly.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smart Wool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Continuing into our second hour of this program, Wednesday morning, February the 12th, 2020, and so glad to have all you listeners out there staying with us. Our phone number is 244-1777 for anybody who wants to call up and weigh in on the issues of the day. We're talking about mainly the New Hampshire primary. It's obviously an exciting time for our neighbors in the Granite State. They get this one day every 4 years to really step to the fore and shine in their role in presidential politics. Some folks question whether that is something that should continue to happen long into the future, but they certainly love it in New Hampshire, and who could blame them? It is an exciting political time. Yesterday's results, Bernie Sanders emerges as the narrow victor. Second place, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. And we see Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren apparently fading. Amy Klobuchar staying in there and hanging stronger than maybe some people expected. So she might be a bit of a dark horse here. And, of course, the elephant in the room, proverbial anyway, former elephant, I guess former Republican, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, is someone who is whose presence was, I think, felt to some extent in New Hampshire. I think one of the small towns that initially opened the voting right around midnight on very early Tuesday, primary day, went strongly for Bloomberg. And so not sure exactly how that worked out, but because he wasn't on the ballot and they had to write him in, I guess. Anyway, Michael Bloomberg is expected to get into the race later on, and he's already been advertising like crazy. You can't turn on the TV these days without seeing a Bloomberg ad. So it is an interesting time for the folks there in New Hampshire, and now the spotlight shifts over to Nevada, the western part of the country, and Nevada has its caucuses upcoming, and then of course South Carolina. One of the complaints about both Iowa and New Hampshire is that they are predominantly white jurisdictions, and that there is a difficulty sometimes with really getting a good representative sample of where America is going when you start out your presidential selection process in places that are so overwhelmingly white. That is typically offset by the South Carolina primary upcoming. I believe the South Carolina Democratic Party, anyway, is majority minority. So there you go. Anyway, we have a CBS News correspondent, I believe, who's still on the ground in New Hampshire, if I'm not mistaken. Steve Dorsey's with us this morning. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning from your backyard.
Yes, indeed. So tell me about your thoughts on New Hampshire. Did Sanders win by enough to really make it a victory, or was it so narrow that it doesn't feel like is a celebratory a time for him?
Well, I think he got the win he needed, and perhaps Pete Buttigieg got the win he needed. I think both of them came out as winners. Both of them got the momentum that they needed. Remember, there has been in modern times no major party candidate who was able to secure their party's nomination without coming in first or second in New Hampshire. So this bodes well for both of their campaigns.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, of course, it also sets up a continuing kind of struggle within the Democratic Party between the kind of moderate wing of the party, centrist, I guess people call it, versus Bernie Sanders on the left, who is obviously has a big push for things like Medicare for all and free public college and so on and so forth. I'm just wondering, do you have any thoughts on how the Democratic Party eventually resolves this?
Well, I think the Democratic Party is changing. I think part of this is a reaction to President Trump. I think we saw in exit polling yesterday, 81% of Democrats voting in New Hampshire surveyed that said they were angry with the Trump administration. They wanted change. And most were interested in a candidate that could compete with Donald Trump than one that agreed with the issues that they were passionate about. I mean, can Bernie Sanders, or is Bernie Sanders the best one to do that? Moderate Democrats will tell you no, and we'll likely see that play out in other states like Nevada and South Carolina come up next.
Now, I don't know how much this counts or much, but, you know, in the case of Bernie Sanders, he has run, of course, numerous times in Vermont now as both a member of the U.S. House and a member of the right. U.S. Senate, and has attracted support here from quite conservative parts of the state. If you look at the individual town-by-town voting results, you'll see the town going strongly for a Republican gubernatorial candidate, for instance, and then for Bernie Sanders for U.S. House or Senate. And people sort of look at that and they say Sanders apparently has some cross-ideological appeal here. Is that translatable to the national scene?
Absolutely. I think there are supporters of Bernie Sanders who would also support President Trump. And that's a weird paradox, mm-hmm. but they are similar on issues, including getting the U.S. out of foreign wars, ending the role of America as policemen across the world. That's what I think attracts voters to both of those candidates.
I also have a sense sometimes that the similarity between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump might stem a little bit from this. And I think back to 2016 when Hillary Clinton took a lot of criticism for giving a series of speeches. I think they were carried six-figure fees for speaking engagements at the investment house Goldman Sachs in New York. And she was asked repeatedly to tell folks, well, what'd you tell Goldman Sachs in these speeches? Well, give us a transcript or, et cetera.
Yeah.
Wouldn't do that. And that kind of gave off this aura that Hillary Clinton was a member of this kind of 1% club, which right. They're having their meetings and they're deciding what the future course of America is going to be, and they're not telling the rest of us about it. And Donald Trump, despite his own economic background and so on, managed to convey himself as a representative of the other 99%. And Bernie Sanders certainly a longtime representative of the other 99%. Is that a fair analogy? Would you say?
Yeah, you should do a master's on that because I think it's right on the money, literally and figuratively. I think that's an important characteristic of both, and money does have a lot of influence in this, and classism is really important here.
Mm-hmm.
Both are coming out saying that they are against the elites, and they want to get those elites out of power and have the working man take their place.
It is pretty fascinating. I mean, and again, Donald Trump, I think a lot of liberals and Trump critics would say he was sort of the fake tribune of the 99%. Bernie Sanders, I don't think he's going to end up in any situation where he is criticized for his past bankruptcies and unpaid contractors and failed universities and failed et cetera, et cetera. So different, completely different backgrounds from the point of view of business records and so on. But Sanders doesn't really have one to speak of. And I'm wondering if you think that when all of this goes south, literally like South Carolina, that Sanders' shtick here is saleable there.
Well, that's a big problem because right now Joe Biden is actually leading in South Carolina. Tom Steyer, a billionaire, is right behind him. So does Bernie Sanders connect with minority voters? That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, does the anti-billionaire message also play well in South Carolina. I mean, you know, Tom Steyer, a billionaire, is number two in the polls. So that's going to be a real test of his campaign.
And of course, and then Michael Bloomberg waits in the wings as well. So
with another billionaire who's really doubling down on TV ad buys, and that's going to spell trouble for Democrats who are, you know, going to try to outspend them, but probably can't.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you think that voters eventually might sort of start to discount some of this this carpet bombing by Bloomberg? I mean, will people tune it out?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's only so much TV ads you can watch before you get frustrated or before you just block it out altogether. I mean, you can't run a campaign solely based on advertising. You got to have a real message, and you got to have a real foundation for your campaign.
Got to have a ground game too. You got to have actually people out on the street corners talking to folks. So that's
exactly
that's a big part of it as well. Well, we'll have to see what unfolds as these next primary contests come. I wouldn't be surprised. I hope anyway that we can talk again, Steve Dorsey, CBS News, about the next ones down the road, and when we'll get together then.
Thank
you so much. Well, we've got time for a few listener calls here. Folks want to chime in and tell us what you think about the outcome in New Hampshire yesterday. We'll start out with David from Burlington. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Doing well. How are you doing?
There's a much bigger story right now, frankly, in my opinion, than the New Hampshire primary. And it's the story of the four prosecutors quitting in protest over Trump's meddling in the sentencing hearings for Roger Stone. However, since the story of the day is New Hampshire, I'll give you a brief little thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me that you've read McKay Coppin's piece in The Atlantic about Brad Parscale.
I have not.
I'm going to beg anybody listening to find this. It's very easy to find online. It's from The Atlantic magazine. It's by a journalist called McKay Coppin's.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how Trump is weaponizing social media, micro-targeting people who view these little ads, and is essentially going to sway the election by spreading lies and misinformation. It's just absolutely staggering.
This is by McKay, and that's M-C, capital K-A-Y, Coppens, C-O-P-P-E-N-S?
I believe so, yeah. But if you just type Atlantic Magazine, Brad Parscale. Parscale's the guy who helped hand the election to Trump last time. Came from nowhere, set up an organization to mobilize the nefarious forces of the internet. Mm-hmm. To spread lies and help elect Trump. Every intelligence agency in the United States came out and said that the Russians were doing all kinds of mischief online last time and helping Trump get elected. And it's just gone on now. Trump says it didn't happen. It's happening again. This is no wild-eyed conspiracy theory. The whole thing is very well documented. So the reason I mention this is because I'm a huge fan of Bernie Sanders. He was a terrific mayor. He's going to put Trump back in the White House. I hate to say it. It's simply this way. If, in fact, he becomes the nominee of the Democrat Party,
mm-hmm.
Trump will crush him without breaking a sweat. By lying, by running pictures of Bernie with a hammer and sickle behind him, by pointing out that Bernie took his honeymoon in Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the Sandinistas, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't see Bernie putting really up much of a fight against Trump just because Trump fights dirty. That's how he won last time. And if... the problem is Bernie's supporters won't come out for any, many of Bernie's supporters, I shouldn't say, shouldn't make a blanket statement. A significant portion of people who support Sanders, as I have, heck, I sent money last time around.
Mm-hmm.
a significant portion of his supporters won't turn out at the polls in the general election this time around if Bernie isn't the candidate.
You know, I think that what Bernie Sanders is counting on, if he is his strategy, if he becomes the Democratic nominee and runs in the general election, is that he really wants to find a lot of people out there who have not voted in years or maybe ever, because they believe they are cut out of the process. They don't have any impact, or they feel like that essentially the whole economic/political system is rigged against them, and why bother, kind of thing. That's the there is a segment of the population, and this is why our voting totals, our turnout totals on election days are way less than 100%. I mean, this is the theory you hear from Sanders supporters.
That this is a noble.
You bring out at least half of those people, you know, an additional 10 million people, and you can turn an election by through this process of registering first-time voters and et cetera. And if Bernie Sanders is not the nominee, then that part of the game is kind of over. And so, yeah, I mean, you could make that argument that Bernie Sanders supporters stay home if he doesn't win the nomination, or at least some of them do. But they hadn't been showing up previously, right?
Yeah. I mean, Lord knows I'd love to be wrong about this.
Mm-hmm.
But Trump crushed in the Electoral College, which is what matters.
Yep.
Perhaps the most qualified candidate to run since George Bush the Elder.
Yeah.
And it was done with dirty tricks, weaponizing the internet, spreading lies, suppressing the vote.
There was some of that going on, but you know what I think a bigger issue in that campaign was, David? I think Hillary Clinton was a failed candidate in many ways, and one of the ways in which she was a failed candidate was she didn't understand that the big dynamic in 2016 was the 1% versus the 99%. And she so clearly marked herself as a member of the 1% by going to Goldman Sachs, delivering those six-figure speeches, and then saying to the general public, "No, you can't find out what I told them."
Yep,
I'm not going to release my speeches. No transcripts. It was all behind closed doors, in secret. I got my six-figure fees for delivering these speeches, and I'm in tight with these Goldman Sachs people. Was essentially the basic message.
Yeah.
Donald Trump comes along and says, "Hey, I'm from Queens. I don't hang with the Goldman Sachs people." I mean, and you can make a pretty cogent argument. I would think that the idea that Trump is not in with the billionaires is a little bit of fiction. But that was his basic argument: is I'm representing the working stiffs out there, the people who don't go to Goldman Sachs meetings, right?
What fools are we?
Well,
I mean, my gosh, there are a significant number of people who voted for Barack Obama and then voted for Donald Trump. I'm sorry, I just don't understand. The people go to the polls without having read a newspaper and looked into who these people are.
Yeah, I think that remember, a lot of this happens at the margins. You know, people are kind of electoral waves happen. They seem huge and they seem impactful because they win elections by 2 or 3percent, and then they go down in history that way. But really, these things, there's a huge ocean out there that's bigger than any individual tide. And that's what people have to remember, I think. So, hey, I got to jump to a couple other callers, but David, I thank you for the call. Let's keep in touch. Let's go to Bob in Plainfield. Good morning, Bob. Good morning,
Hello,
Bob.
Vinci. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay. One of the things that caller brought up was about Trump saying that Bernie went to Russia, Bernie did this, Bernie did that, and then he calls him a liar. I think everything that he just said was the truth.
Whose travels in Russia are you more bothered by, Bob? Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump's?
I'm not bothered by either one. I'm just saying that when you call the man a liar and everything that he mentioned was true. Bernie did everything that he mentioned, that Trump mentioned. He wasn't lying about that stuff. You know, you can take it from where you want after, but all these people, the first thing out of their mouth is Trump lies. I don't know any politician, I'm sorry, that hasn't lied. They get up there and somebody else writes their speeches, and if they get it wrong and they read it, it's their fault. So,
well, it effectively is, because they're finally responsible for what they're saying. And I think it's a matter of degree, too. No, I've never known a politician who got 100% of his facts or her facts right for, you know, years on end. But as a matter of degree, we've had very careful fact checkers at the Washington Post and elsewhere over time document that President Trump has uttered more than 16,000 falsehoods during the course of his presidency in, you know, a little over 3 years now. I mean, that's just remarkable, isn't it?
It is remarkable. And what else is remarkable is that he's done more than most of them in that 3 years that have been there 40 or 50 years.
Well, I don't remember the last president there 40 or 50 years, but hey, I got to jump, Bob. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Michael in Waitsfield. Good morning, Michael. Maybe Michael's not there. Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Hi, today. Look, I think Michael Bloomberg is going to be the new czar of the Democratic Party, whether you're in local, state, or federal politics.
Michael Bloomberg?
Yeah, he's going to be the new czar.
Okay.
For a good reason, because he's got money. So if you want to, you know, get any money, you're going to have to check in with Mike.
Okay. He's got a lot of money. It's kind of it's amazing how wealth gets accumulated. And are you at all concerned that folks might be skeptical that he would represent the population at large, or is he really just going to represent the billionaire class?
I personally, I don't think Mike's going to be able to make it in. I don't think he'll get in. I think Bernie will beat him. Any of the other Democrats will beat him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's got that kind of oomph, I guess you'd call it. But when it comes to politics as a whole, Mike has got enough money. If you want to get into politics and you need money, you're going to have to check in with him. There's no question about it.
Well, he's certainly one of the people. I mean, I think I heard the other night that 40 billionaires were supporting Pete Buttigieg in his campaign. And so apparently, I mean, we all understand.
I don't know who, 40, but name one. Name two, name three. Mike's got the name. He's a big guy.
Yep, I get you. Okay, thanks for the call, Fred. Appreciate it. Hey, we got another Fred for Barry. Can you read real quick, because we're running into a bottom of the hour break here, Fred?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, you're talking about the New Hampshire primaries, and when Bernie to become a Democrat? You know, he just ran for senator again as an independent. Mm-hmm. Now he wasn't, you know, are they going to open him welcome arms to be the leader of our Democratic Party? And that's our new front runner?
I think you make a good point. I don't understand it myself. I mean, he either should have become a Democrat, or he should have said, I'm going to run as an independent and make it a three-way race, I guess. But who knows? I've never understood the strategy. If I got him on the air here, I'd ask him that. That's a good question. But he's not been real willing. So, all righty. Well, hey, we got to jump for a bottom of the hour news from CBS. But thanks for the call, Fred. Appreciate it. We are going to do that here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and a couple words from our sponsors, and we'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks, from fun to functional, blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont, the almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We continue into the final half hour of our program this morning. And we are hoping to get connected up with Linda Fowler. She's a professor of political science at Dartmouth College, and has been, I think, following some of the events connected with the New Hampshire primary. Dartmouth, of course, is located in New Hampshire, and might have to ask her about the difference in vote totals between Hanover, one college town, and Durham, where the State University of New Hampshire is located. But maybe we'll go to some more general questions first. I believe we have Linda Fowler now with us on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Thank you so much, Professor Linda Fowler of Dartmouth College, for joining our program this morning. What are you, first off, what are your general thoughts about the outcome in New Hampshire yesterday?
Oh, my goodness. It's hard to know. There were so many things that were interesting.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, New Hampshire did perform its usual function of narrowing the field with both Andrew Yang and Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado, dropping out.
Yep.
But it also provided very bad news for Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. Warren organized the state very early on, and she was really doing well here. But she's got to be very disappointed about her showing. And she and Amy Klobuchar are basically now tied, along with for third place, but Amy is actually ahead of her for third place. But, you know, we're talking a few hundred votes difference, I think.
Yeah. Elizabeth Warren, it is kind of shocking because she comes from Massachusetts. And, you know, I've sort of half jokingly ribbed New Hampshire a little bit over you know, on a few times on the program here, talking about a sort of New England bias, because when a New England candidate gets into the race, they tend to do, you know, you think about Ed Muskie back in 1972, he was from Maine and won New Hampshire and then promptly fizzled. Paul Tsongas in 1992, mm-hmm. same story. He was from just downriver in Lowell, Mass, and won the New Hampshire primary. So, you know, I've joked with friends of mine in New Hampshire. I said, you know, I think your qualification over there, the big one, is you got to be a Red Sox fan or something.
Well, and New Hampshire has also a reputation for being ornery and unpredictable.
Yep.
Remember in 2000, they went for John McCain big time, and that sort of fizzled in the end. McCain wiped out in South Carolina and then in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
But they also provided a shock to Bob Dole in the Republican primary in 1996 with Pat Buchanan.
Yeah.
So
that was a shocker.
Yeah. So Amy Klobuchar, I went to one of her rallies and thought that she was just the kind of centrist Democrat that would appeal to New Hampshire voters. And her problem was she was very late organizing the state and had almost no staff presence here until December.
Wow.
So what she pulled off in a month was pretty impressive. Whether it's going to be enough for her to get the money and the volunteers and the staffers she needs to go into South Carolina and Nevada, which is the last contest in February, and then Super Tuesday. She's barely registering in the polls out in California, which is has the most delegates, and Bernie is leading there, and Michael Bloomberg is actually doing very well out there. He's getting quite a nice return on his $250 million ad buys.
Yikes.
Yikes. So I guess the other thing that was interesting to me is that Bernie Sanders beat Hillary Clinton in this state with 60% of the vote. So there are a lot of people who voted for him in 2016 who found other candidates more attractive. Some of them were with Warren, but clearly the moderate wing of the party is stronger in New Hampshire than the progressive wing, and you know, if you look at the aggregate totals of, and so he, you know, he got the good headline. He's the front runner, and he's also the front runner in national polls. But I actually think he didn't do well here.
Yeah,
compared to what he had done.
I think the 2016 election may have been more the outlier, really, because my sense of that was, even among Democrats, there was a lot of protest voting against Hillary Clinton, frankly.
Yes, and, people just didn't like her.
And I think, you know, as I was just saying before the break with another, with one of our callers, I think she really set herself up. One of her biggest mistakes, I think, personally, and you tell me if you think this makes any sense, but you remember the whole episode with the talks, the six-figure speeches she gave at Goldman Sachs and then refused to release the contents of those speeches?
Yeah.
I mean, that was basically a big statement that I am one of the 1%, and I'm not even going to tell you what we're talking about.
Yeah. More important, when I looked at the exit polls after the 2016 caucuses in Nevada and the primary here in New Hampshire, people thought she was experienced. They thought she was intelligent and capable.
Mm-hmm.
They thought she was not trustworthy. 70% thought she couldn't be trusted, and another 70% thought she didn't care about people like them. And that just plagued her, and it provided the opportunity that Bernie exploited quite brilliantly, that
yeah.
She had things to hide. And then, of course, having prepared that soil so well, it was an easy matter for Trump to play on the crooked Hillary theme.
So
Biden must have known from internal polling that he was going to do badly here. And that everything, his campaign really depends on his appeal to black voters in South Carolina to keep him alive until he can go into some of the big industrial states or go into Texas and California on March 3rd. But I'm long in the tooth, not as long in the tooth as he is, but people in my age group that you might think would be supporting Biden, and some of them are,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of people I talk to who are on Medicare think he's too old.
Yeah, it is interesting.
We would know.
Well, that's the thing is I know, you know, I have relatives and friends who are, you know, up in their 70s or even 80s, and a lot of them are very suspicious of Biden, in part because, you know, he looks like them, they feel on their worst days. And that's just tough. I don't know what, you know, I mean, call it ageism or whatever, but I think sometimes there is that a little bit of familiarity there or something.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to bring in a listener. We have a listener calling in. Let's make it a talk show here. Hey Rama from Williamstown, what's going on with you?
Yeah. Just real quick, I want to throw in one thing that seems to be getting left out of this discussion, and I don't know, and by this discussion, by the way, Dave, I do mean this specific one here. This
okay.
Time. Okay.
All right.
Just to differentiate.
Yeah.
So there, and I think it's because it hasn't really hit the radar yet, what I'm going to say here, and that is that there is a stronger anti-Trump vote out there than is being recognized. And I am saying this based on some conversations I have had on personal levels with people. So it's anecdotal, but it's really surprising the different angles where the people are coming and saying, and I'll tell you, Bloomberg, by the way, is going to pick up, seems to be, like he, by the sounds of it, is going to pick up a good portion of these for support, people who voted for Trump. I can tell you right now, have said they will go vote for Bloomberg. You know, so I think possibly some of this progressive wing, moderate wing of the Democratic Party is a little bit, I would term it a little bit political silliness, but because there are pressures out there that are coming to bear that are getting people to make decisions in different ways.
So this progressive moderate debate is what walks when Bloomberg's money talks.
Well, it's not that. It's Bloomberg is being seen as a person who can and will stand up and beat Trump.
Okay. Rama, thanks for the call.
Linda
Fowler, what do you think about all that?
Well, I actually agree with your caller that there's a lot of latent antagonism to Trump. People who I heard from one person, I was a Trump voter, but I'm not a Trump supporter. And I'm hearing the same thing, and that's really where the progressive versus moderate conversation is not trivial, because the moderates they don't know how big that crossover vote might be, but they understand that particularly in competitive states, purple states, where that have electoral college votes, that they can only win those states back from Trump if they get crossover votes from Trump voters last time.
Yeah.
And this is why people like me think that a Sanders candidacy would be a disaster for the party, because those voters that your caller is referring to are not going to vote for him.
Is there anything to be said, though, just to play devil's advocate here a little bit, for the kind of pure elixir argument? I mean, Trump was definitely a standout as somebody who really wanted to go to the right in a lot of different ways among the Republican candidates for in 2016, in that primary season. You know, you compare him to Jeb Bush, or certainly Kasich from Ohio, and others on the dais there. He was somebody who was really kind of eager to try to, you know,
But only on immigration and tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, he promised to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He was all about infrastructure. He was reassuring to a lot of working Democrats who were feeling economic pinch and that the Democratic Party wasn't listening to them anymore. And all the manufacturing jobs that were going to come back. And so he's his own brand.
Yeah.
And
yep.
He was in 2016, and basically the party has moved to embrace his their reluctant protectionists now, and mm-hmm. they're worried about the withdrawal from world affairs. But again, he was not an orthodox conservative on America's role in the world.
Do you think that Sanders could pull off the same thing on the left, sort of the other bookend?
Well, in this election season, anything's possible, isn't it?
So yeah.
I'm not going to say no, but I think what has to happen in the Democratic Party, that it has to get down to two candidates. The Sanders view of the world, that if we adopt the expanding the social welfare state, new voters will come into the electorate and we will win, even if we lose the people who voted for Obama and then for Trump in 2016. The fact that he's not generating record turnout in either Iowa or New Hampshire is problematic for that argument. But it's really the more centrist people who want to keep the suburban voters who left the Republicans in 2018 and want to attract some Trump voters. Those people have to get behind somebody. It's not clear. And they thought it was going to be Biden, but it's not clear that that's the place to go for them.
Yeah. Do you think that the voters out there are ready for admitting into the race somebody like a Bloomberg who shows up late just with a ton of money? I mean, it'll be a plainly obvious situation where the billionaire came in with $250 million in ads, and here I am, and elect me. Is that going to sell?
Well, the one thing that is clear from this so far is that Democratic voters want to beat Trump. That's their first priority.
Yeah,
if they get convinced that Bloomberg is the one to do it, then, I think some of the Bernie people will see that as such a sellout of the party that they may stay home. But a number of other people who are worried about the direction that Bernie was taking the party may find this reassuring, particularly if Bloomberg picks a running mate who's attractive to core constituencies in the party. They may not like it, but they'll live with it.
In terms of the Trump voters, disillusioned Trump voters, as Pete Buttigieg calls them, I think, future former Republicans, are these folks, is it more a matter of he's failed to keep his promises on really getting us past the immigration quote unquote problem, or if he's failed to keep his promises on infrastructure. You know, he's making noises about yes, he can and will damage Social Security and Medicare.
I think for a lot of moderate Republicans, particularly suburban Republicans, it's health care. Mm-hmm. That he's embraced the conservative antipathy to Obamacare and is both joining the lawsuit to overturn it and has done a variety of ways to reduce participation. So I think with suburban voters who are worried about the cost of health care, that could keep them in the Democratic Party for this election if they feel comfortable with other parts of the nominee's platform.
Yeah.
Not the wealth tax, for example.
You don't think the wealth tax is a seller?
I don't. And actually, having read a lot of the literature on wealth taxes, believe it or not, there's not enough money there.
You know, that is one of the things I've heard from time to time over the years when I've looked into, frankly, some of Bernie Sanders' proposals as well, his tax proposals back when he was first running for Congress and so on. And it is remarkable that once you start looking into the numbers, you realize there just aren't that many people who are that rich.
And so it would generate some money, there has to be tax reform about mm-hmm. the whole structure of the tax code to generate the revenue that the country needs for infrastructure and some really basic things that have been neglected.
And Linda, I wanted to ask you about the Democratic field and which of any of these candidates is going to have an ability to essentially attract voters of color. We don't have Cory Booker in the race anymore. We don't have Kamala Harris in the race anymore. It's quite a white field left, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about any of these folks having a special connection there.
Well, black voters are key in primary races because they make up such a disproportionate percentage of Southern Democratic parties. So mm-hmm. particularly in South Carolina, Texas, and some other states, southern states that will be voting in on March 3rd. On the other hand, I think black voters didn't turn out in the record numbers that they had for Obama in 2016, but you get the sense from a couple of polls that I've seen that they understand that the stakes are pretty high. Mm-hmm. And higher than maybe they assumed in 2016. And so I think they, you know, they may not be happy about it, but I think they're loyal Democratic voters, and I think enough of them will show up. The real issue, I think, with respect to black voters and Latino voters is how much the efforts by Republicans on vote suppression are going to take their toll or make people feel that it's not worth it. There's some very interesting political science research that's been being published now about the effects of various efforts to discourage people from voting, whether it's not having enough polling places or purging people from the rolls over technicalities. You know, the middle initial is different or absent and so forth. So those had a significant effect in close races in 2016. So that's as much a worry, I think, as whether blacks are feeling neglected by the party.
I kind of slap my forehead and I'm just saying this is America in 2020. And we're still worried about people of color having the right to vote, is what this comes down to, and I think people ought to be outraged by that, frankly. And one of the things that I really wish Mike Bloomberg and Tom Steyer would do with their billions would be to set up some kind of a structure. And you know, Stacey Abrams has a group, which is I think. I'm trying to remember the name of it right now, but she has this group that is devoted purely to making sure that people are registered to vote, and that they're going to be able to vote come election day, And it's kind of that underlying infrastructure, which, I mean, if you really had a concerted effort in every precinct where Republicans were trying to suppress the vote, to counter that by, you know, making sure, okay, this polling place is now closed. Well, we're going to create van pools to take everybody the 3 miles to the other voting place or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever yeah. it takes. We're going to make sure that, you know, we're going to go down to the neighborhood and make sure that every grandmother has a photo ID if that's what's required, you know. And on. I mean, I just think there are ways to fight back here in very kind of nitty gritty with very, very sort of nitty gritty methods like that. And
you're correct that it takes money.
It takes money. And you know, when I see these vanity campaigns on Bloomberg and Steyer's part, I kind of go, guys, you know, if you really want to spend money, you know, you say your most important goal is to defeat Donald Trump. Well, I got a much better way for you to spend some money. You know, I just
now you sound like my husband, Dave. That's what he's been saying.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think it kind of makes sense. That's probably, I mean, it's
yeah,
just
right.
It's just people need to take this very, very seriously. I mean, I personally, I'm horrified by the very idea that anybody is out there trying to suppress the vote of certain neighborhoods or precincts because they are predominantly people yeah. of color. That disgusts me. You know, that really, wow. And
in New Hampshire, it's also been to suppress the vote of students.
Yeah, well, there is that controversy as well, which we're probably going to have to leave for another day because we are just about at the top of the hour and the end of my show for this Wednesday morning. Linda Fowler of Dartmouth College, I really want to thank you for joining me. Let's have another chat in the near future.
It's always fun to talk to you, Dave. Bye.
Alrighty. We will call it a day for this edition of the Dave Graham Show, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of our show. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, our midday news service, and the beat goes on here at WDEV FM and AM. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great afternoon.